Podcast One.
Hi, this is Paul McIntyre. Welcome to the MI3 Audio Edition. I've been a business journalist for 25 years covering the marketing, media, agency and tech sectors. In this series, we talk to industry leaders about the global and local developments that you need to be across this week. Well, welcome to our first audio edition for 2021, and it's a cracker. Before we jump into a fascinating conversation with Menulog's Chief Marketing Officer, Simon Cheng, and how he's outgrowing the mighty Uber Eats, you'll see when you jump over to mi-3.com.au that we've redesigned and relaunched our website and have some new announcements about MI3's new editor, Brendan Coyne, and some super additions to the MI3 editorial team. Check it out. I'm very happy about our overhaul, and much more is to come this year. But let's get to food delivery aggregators, startups, media mix, and what the future of food delivery might look like. We did a story mid last year with Simon at Menulog on how he was managing the business and brand through COVID, and it went off with MI3's audience. It was one of our biggest stories for 2020, partly because of Snoop Dogg's allure in a Menulog campaign, I suspect, but more because Simon's a CMO at a digital pure play saying crazy things like TV, radio, and out of home remain powerful marketing channels, and why and how he's managing brand building and performance marketing. And of course, Menulog is growing like crazy, and we like a good news story. 6 months on from our last conversation with Simon, Menulog in Australia continues its growth march. It's the best performing country in Menulog's portfolio, and as we're about to hear, it's closing in on Uber Eats dominance. So welcome, Simon Cheng. Let's start with the big question. How is Menulog tracking versus Uber Eats and Deliveroo? It's a good news story, I think, for you in that you're increasing your market share, I think.
G'day, Paul. Very lovely to be here. Thank you very much for the kind invitation to get involved with this and tell the Menulog story. Just a small correction to what you said up front. The global business is actually known as Just Eat Takeaway, of which we are known as Menulog in Australia.
Got it.
But globally, particularly in the European markets, we are known as Just Eat Takeaway.
Some of my detractors will love that on-air correction. So well done, Simon. Good one.
So look, Menulog has been a fantastic growth story over the last 18 months to 2 years, actually. You only need to look at Google Trends during the COVID period over the last 12 months to see the market share gains that the business has made on our competitors. I guess even before the pandemic, going into that period, we were experiencing double-digit growth. So our growth actually started before the COVID-induced period, which a lot of people probably didn't realize. And so that's because we put a number of strategies in place prior to that meant that we were growing double digit already going into the period when all the lockdown started in March. Now, obviously, when it started in March, you know, a lot of restaurants started closing, and we found ourselves in a position of being considered an essential service. And the only way for restaurants to remain in business were to be able to deliver. We immediately experienced triple digit growth. And so that's a pretty big deal for a business that had been around for 15 years. And leading up to that point, prior to kind of 2019, was facing some challenging times with some of the competition who arrived into the country. And so we saw triple digit growth as we went into that COVID period, and even coming, I guess the country's still in this period, but as restrictions started lightening up and we started coming out of the winter period where we traditionally trade quite well, and as we go into summer, we're quite a seasonal business, we'd normally trade down, we're continuing to grow. And so we only just announced our Q4 2020 trading results recently. And so to give you an idea of how the Australian market compares, or the Menulog brand compares to the rest of the world, the COVID pandemic has been, has left the entire industry in a very fortunate position. The Just Eat Takeaway global business announced a 57% year-on-year growth for Q4 2020.
That was revenue, was it, Simon?
That's orders growth.
Orders growth, right.
Yeah, that's top-level orders growth.
Yep.
And in Australia, we saw 166% growth in that Q4 period. So almost triple the amount of orders that we did in the same period last year.
Tell me, what is it about Australia that's working? I mean, it's good growth globally, but what are you doing differently here? What are the dynamics or the market dynamics that are different, or the marketing and that how the business is operating here? What's going on?
Look, I'd love to take all credit for it, for marketing. I mean, marketing plays a part, obviously, but look, the business is run by a really, you know, great group of collaborative, intelligent leadership team, and it's the sum of all its parts, right? We obviously had a natural organic bump thanks to the current environment with COVID and many more people likely to order delivery. But the fact that we've outgrown the global market by so much, it's because of it. There's a number of strategies we put in place in Australia. In particular, there were a few big bets we made early on in the period when we could see a period coming where restaurants would be closed. And so we had really strong relationships already with industry lobby groups to work with them in lobbying the government to convince them that restaurants should be able to continue staying open for delivery, and so what we did at that time as well was we made a big bet in investing in our sales teams to go and sign up more restaurants and for lesser commission than we normally would and lesser commission than the competitors. We also worked with a lot of these restaurants in trying to existing restaurants on our platform to convert front of house staff into delivery drivers so that they wouldn't need to lay off any staff. And so the combination of that and signing up a lot more new restaurants in that period really helped contribute to the growth in that period.
And I think we talked earlier about the exclusivity changed of the whole market, right? So up until then, there was more exclusive arrangements between the competing delivery aggregators, but that changed, I think you said.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so up until that point, I guess I liken it to the travel industry. About 15-odd years ago, when a lot of the big aggregators started coming up, your What Ifs, your Expedias, Booking.coms and all that, right? And around that period at the start, a lot of these aggregators had niches in terms of, they only aggregate boutique hotels, or these guys only did smaller hotels, and these ones are big chains, et cetera. And eventually, consolidation happened in the industry, and it was a commoditized product range, right? Everyone offers every type of hotel out there possible, right? And we were going through that. Our industry was going through a similar kind of consolidation, and COVID's just accelerated that.
By what, 2 or 3 years, do you think?
Definitely. I would say, look, the penetration and the growth has definitely accelerated us to kind of an end point of 2 to 3 years, where we would have been in 2 to 3 years' time. And that's meant that exclusivity arrangements that were in place before, a lot of them were broken at the beginning of COVID or have been during that period through winter last year. And it meant that everyone has essentially almost got everyone, all the restaurants on the platforms now, right? And we knew that point was coming, and that's why we believe that over the next 2 to 3 years, the biggest differentiator for us was going to be investing in marketing, investing in customer experience, differentiation through that way, as well as obviously tech makes a big difference, right? But definitely through customer experience, through your service delivery, through your marketing and how you are perceived, that were going to be the main differentiators.
Penetration for food delivery apps is at what, 85-90% perhaps? Is that where it's got to now?
Yeah, penetration is probably closer to about half the market have used have used it at some point in time.
Okay.
But what's happened during this pandemic period is that the number of users who now have multiple apps on their phone have increased. And so what we see now is 4 out of 5 people who use a food delivery service will have multiple apps on their phone. And so what that means is that it differentiation is even harder, and it becomes a mental availability game.
Yes, and it's fascinating. We're going to get to that in a sec, but MenuLog is growing and you're growing share. So what is it about this mental availability play that you're doing, and how are people behaving when they've got their phones and their apps, and which one they decide to use in terms of an aggregator? What are you doing?
Mental availability is built through reaching as many people as possible, as consistent as possible, and with a regular frequency, I guess, right? And these are all kind of the textbook type definitions, but we certainly subscribe to that. I mean, our business, we are a tech business, we're a digital pure play business, but we use a lot of traditional channels in TV, outdoor, and radio, and so we invest a lot in those channels because we believe that they are very successful in building mental availability. They are still one of the most effective effective ways to reach a mass audience and gain attention of mass audiences. I mean, if you were to look at something like YouTube and Google, you could probably argue that they have much higher reach than some of these other channels, but the attention of those channels are a lot harder to build brands with. And that's why we continue to invest so much in traditional channels like TV and BVOD. You know, BVOD I consider a similar channel in building brands to linear TV. BVOD potentially you could argue is a more premium channel than linear TV. But that's why.
So it's just not now for the game for you in terms of how you're marketing and this mental availability and reach and frequency, which is obviously decades old, and you've got a digital pure play marketer like you talking reach and frequency, which is in a whole world sometimes seen as a bit old school and a bit old fashioned, but real and live and working. I think it's a fascinating. Well, hopefully we'll drill down to that a little bit more. But again, this is not just about your mainstream's not just about getting people to download the app. You're also using it to use the app more often. That's part of the strategy. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And you know, it's not rocket science. You know, all marketers will tell you, and you'll learn this in university, that it's about acquiring customers, and then it's about retaining them. Mm. And we have a very strong focus on both of them. Many businesses can get quite distracted, I guess, from some of the bigger picture goals. And that's one thing we're probably very relentless and ruthless on to ensure that, you know, we have a really strong growth mindset. And clearly we do when you look at the outcomes. We have a really strong growth mindset in this business, and we know what it takes to grow. And we are just relentless at driving the channels or the initiatives or the activities to achieve that.
Just run through then, Simon. I mean, we won't get into great detail because it's probably strategically you like to keep it tight, but channels in terms of their efficacy, their effectiveness for what? If you even talked about on in our previous conversation about radio being in play for you and out of home and television, and then you've still got you're ramping up in social and you've got YouTube and you're doing all that. So what are each of the channels used for? Are they combined for the same thing, or have they got specialisms that you're looking to for them to deliver individually?
We take a kind of two-tier approach. We have, you know, our brand activity and our performance activity. Not rocket science, like I said before. We're just very clear in what each channel's role is, I guess. And you know, the brand and performance thing, we may have spent a bit of time talking about the traditional channels just then, and that obviously plays a bigger part in the brand side of things. But performance is just as important for us, obviously, because we're a tech, you know, we're a digital player. But there's no point in spending so much at this end of the funnel and creating demand, you know, generating all this demand when you're not actually investing anything and capturing the demand.
Right.
And so that's why we have this balanced approach in brand and performance. On the brand side of things, like I said before, you know, there are certain channels that I believe are stronger at building brands. We don't actually talk about TV on its own. We talk about a screens approach, which is not a new concept to marketers. It's just a lot of marketers will talk about it, but probably not execute it on that way. And for us, the screens approach is your TV, your BVOD, your YouTube. We see social as an extension of our screen strategy as well. Each of those channels have different levels of efficacy, because of the level of attention and screen time that people have, and the format that and the way you consume it will mean a different way, a different level of absorption of messages, which is why we kind of take a total screens approach. Out of home is in that same mix that helps build brand and mental availability for us, and radio is about a frequency play.
Right.
You know, radio for us last year it would really be missing a trick, I think, if we were launching a campaign with a major, celebrity in Snoop Dogg and not using the audio medium to promote it. The jingle itself has actually become a major brand asset for us, a distinctive brand asset for us. And so using the radio medium it would be an oversight not to include it in the mix. And then on the performance side of things, obviously Google paid search. We invest a lot in performance channels, and we're a major partner of Google here in Australia, and social for us plays a big part as well in performance.
And so in terms of the two things, the changing efficacy or effectiveness of each of those channels and the weighting that you're putting to them last year versus this year, or have you been moving around with that testing and seeing whether what the optimal mix is? Does it look different from 12 months ago?
Yeah, it does. The mix looks very different because we're always learning and optimizing as we go. So every 3 months, the mix will slowly kind of move and optimize to the results that we're trying to achieve, right? And the results we're trying to achieve is, top of mind awareness, or some people call it spontaneous awareness, and general awareness levels. And obviously, ultimately, it's about orders and commercial performance, right? So each of those channels play a different part in attracting different types of audiences. So we're always looking at the types of customers that are coming in and using the product, and then again adjusting accordingly.
And do you see channels that work for a younger customer base versus mid versus old like me? Is there a difference in how you see these things performing by customer type?
Firstly, I don't think you're that old.
Thank you, Paul. Simon. It's the nicest thing someone said to me since New Year's Day.
Yeah, look, different channels obviously appeal to different, demographics of audience. For us, our brand historically has actually been a really strong family brand.
Right.
For the first 13 years of existence, it was very much about families and really that kind of Friday night, Saturday night dinner treat occasion, and the reason for that is the business was started as an aggregator for restaurants that have their own delivery drivers,
right,
and what we call the self-delivery market, right, and those kinds of business, your traditional corner Chinese takeaway, Indian takeaway, pizza shops, all of those guys that have their own delivery drivers, generally existed more so in suburban situations and appeal to the families, etc., right, and a lot of them were doing their own deliveries on that Friday, Saturday, Sunday night occasion. And so that were the roots of the business, right? And so because of that, there was a real stigma to break in terms of who we appealed to and what our product was for. And so one of the big things that unlocked our growth was really putting a line in the sand and telling people that we are not just about dinner. We do more than dinner, and we are not just about families. We also cater to that younger demographic, and particularly in the inner urban areas.
When did that start? When did you sort of start to shift that strategy or that positioning?
In 2019.
Okay.
2019, it was very clear that we'd made a deliberate declaration internally with our own business that we were going to broaden the appeal of the business and brand to really go and chase other demographics, because for a marketplace business like ours, like any kind of marketplace business like an Amazon or an eBay or an Expedia, or it's all about volume and scale, and you actually need to be able to appeal to a very broad demographic of audience, and so to be pigeonholed as just the family brand and just in Friday, Saturday, Sunday, that's what was inhibiting our growth.
Well, it's a really interesting progression of what you've done, particularly with, as you said before, a super competitive set, right? And you've got a big brand out there, a big global brand that's got some momentum behind it on the travel side, and then tapping the Eats. So I'm talking about Uber Eats clearly now, and to be able to match it with that natural momentum that brand has got. You had a lot of work ahead of you to do.
Yeah, we did. It was a big punt actually getting involved with this business in back in 2019. I've only been in the business for just under 2 years. I joined it April 2019. But the business has put its money where its mouth is. We've invested a lot, and and the ambition is to be number one.
And you're closing the gap, you say. So how far? What's the time frame? Should we be able to talk to Simon Ching again and go, okay, Mr. Number One, but what is the objective there? What timeline at least?
We don't think it's going to happen overnight, but we're very happy with the progress we've made so far. Look, speak to me again in another 6 to 12 months, and we can track progress again.
I look forward to that. Absolutely. I will, trust me. And so just out of interest, when you started talking about the investment in brand and some of those legacy media channels to get mental availability and awareness, or beyond awareness, I should say, but repeat. Was that when you came on, or was it happening already? Was MenuLog sort of moving that way, or was that sort of a Simon Ching sort of strategic imperative?
It was developed. It was a new thing that we developed around the around mid 2019,
right,
after I joined. But the business had already started making gains in laying down really, really strong foundations to be able to compete in the market. So one of the biggest changes that was made, one of the biggest pivot points that was made before I joined was the launch of the delivery service. Like I said before, the business was only operating as a marketplace businesses for the restaurants that did their own delivery. And so the decision was made, not long before I joined, to roll out a delivery service. And around the time I joined is when we started to really, really scale that, that service in conjunction with all these other growth strategies that we put in place, after I started.
Well, you're right. You made a comment earlier about it being a big punt for you to join, because if it was me, for instance, I'd sit there and go, What opportunity does MenuLog have when there's a couple of big players out there that have got some momentum? So that punt that you talked about, why did you take it?
Who wants to work for the number one brand in any market?
Right.
As a marketer, you want to work for challenger brands. You want to feel like you can make a difference. That was ultimately what it was about for me. I mean, my background's in working for, I want to work for high growth businesses. Most of the businesses I've worked in have been in high growth categories.
Well, so for our audience, just name a couple. What's your background there on the context of that?
So I've worked in the health and wellness industry for like health wellness retailing. That's a really fast-growing category, and I worked in the cruise industry. I was part of the that kind of 10-year period during the big cruise boom, and prior to that, I worked in I worked a bit at Qantas and in advertising agencies.
And the principles that you were applying to those previous sectors you worked in, was it for what you're doing now at MenuLog? Were they formed then, or was it quite a different approach what you had to do with MenuLog versus what you've done historically?
You've always got to build on the knowledge that you gain in every role, I think, and all the people that you touch and learn from. A lot of the general principles have been taught to me by really smart people in the past I've worked with and in businesses I've worked in. A lot of the strategies we had in place probably 15 years ago are completely outdated now. I remember we spent a lot of money in newspaper advertising in the cruise industry,
right,
which, we wouldn't, I can't remember the last time I worked on a print ad, to be honest.
Yes.
Not to say print advertising doesn't work. It's just the categories I've been in since then hasn't been relevant.
Well, it does get us to this point, though, that you are a little sort of unconventional for a CMO in a digital pure play, in that you still talk about the efficacy of legacy media channels, when many digital marketers, if you like, or digital orientated companies essentially go, it's all digital, you don't need to do any of that legacy stuff, and it's old fashioned and old world, and it's dying or already dead. And this is sort of the narrative that comes through in our industry, right? You're still a fan of that, and so you are unconventional in that context. What is going on with your peers and with the market that says all that stuff, that old world media stuff, is dead or dying and not relevant? You've got a very different approach to that.
Yeah, I will always recommend the best approach I feel is right for them. Brand or the market that we're working in. The reason why I think what you're calling some of these more traditional channels, I believe are appropriate for our business, is that we are a product that appeals to everyone. We're not a niche product. We have ambitions to be a global power brand, a global super brand. The fastest and most efficient way to get there is to use mass market channels that can build a mental availability, build emotional connection. And a lot of these are, more traditional channels help with that. And I mean, maybe that's not quite an accurate statement. I would say channels that are more visually appealing, like, video channels, do a better job at the video and audio channels, provide more dimensions to expressing your brand, right? And so that's why I'm a big believer if your objective is to become a mass market, really well-known brand, then you need to be able to build a multi-dimensional brand that people can kind of touch and feel and understand.
We haven't talked about this, so I'll spring a little surprise on you, but in terms of the attention that goes to the various channels, if you think about, a 5 second or a 15 second ad and a 30 second ad on linear or BVOD versus a sub 2 second exposure on some of the socials, or even on YouTube, where you can actually click and go, I don't want to see the ad. What are the ratios there for you? What about that attention issue? And then I'm fascinated by how many people do you see will watch a full-length menu log ad on YouTube, for instance, without skipping?
All our metrics for our digital versions of the ad have demonstrated that they are in the upper categories of view-through rates for amongst, you know, all online ads.
And that's because the content's good, right? I mean, that's why Snoop Dogg works, I guess, for you and other things that you're doing.
100% it does.
Creative matters, right?
I'm a big believer that creative plays a really big part in creating that mental availability. I mean, that's a buzz term that, Byron Sharp invented. So it sounds like I subscribe to his theories. I would say I find him a little bit extreme. There are certain theories he has that I am big believers on, but I think you need to apply a more pragmatic approach to a lot of them. And I think the mental availability thing, it shouldn't just be about distinction, as he's pointed out. If it was just about that, then you'd just pick a color for your brand that no one else has, and you'd show a 30-second logo on screen and show that frequently and just hope that that currently builds memory structures. But I believe that building emotional connection and having really strong creative product makes a really big difference. And maybe that's because of my agency days, but I'll always be preaching that.
And where were you? What were you doing? You were creative, a suit, a strategic planner, or the mailman?
I started off as a mailman.
So did I.
In dispatch, like all of us do in advertising and making teas and coffees. And actually, I think one of my first jobs was filing. And many people won't know what this is, but filing U-matic tapes.
You're older than you look.
I don't know if that's a compliment or not.
No, that's a big rap. Let me just get back to attention for a moment. So that, we have this discussion about how much attention is enough. And if you think about the fast-paced scroll that's going on in the social feeds and you get a 1-2 second exposure, is that enough for you versus what you might see on BVOD TV or a radio ad in 30 seconds? Where do you sit in that whole what's good enough?
The answer is different by medium, I think, right? And that's why I'm such a big fan of ensuring that you have a strong mix of different types of mediums where you have the ability to convey the message in the time frame that you would like, right? So, and again, why I don't believe that I believe it's challenging to build a really strong brand just using a social channel, for example, right? Where you only have the ability to kind of get people to watch your ad for 3 seconds. Building a brand is very difficult there. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's certainly much harder than in BVOD where people are watching a 30-second piece of content. Now, obviously, the content and the creativity matters. If you've got a piece of a piece of creative on a 30-second ad that isn't very great, a 3-second piece of content that's really good would trump that. Okay, so that's that's obvious, but so my view is creative matters, and creative that is created for the medium, or purpose built for the medium, is important. We're making real conscious effort to ensure that we have a social first approach for our creative. We have a TV first approach for TV only, and not run the TV ad in social, and not run the TV ad in YouTube. And now you're probably going, a lot of your listeners are going to probably now go and have a look and point out all the times that I haven't done that. And,
yes.
And that's and I'll find lots of examples of that. But it's definitely
the intent is there.
100%.
Yeah, and it's great hearing a CMO talk about creative, because here's one of the things that I often talk to a lot of people about is that we are, as an industry, often so obsessed by the channel, by the media channel. We talk about what it delivers in terms of an audience, what it delivers in terms of attention, and the media channel and the buy and the mix. But we talk less about the creative, and it's massively important. But it's a fuzzier concept to get your head around, or it seems to be less sexy. You got any thoughts on why we do that? Why we talk about the channel and the media and less about creative as an industry?
I think it's really sad what's happened in regards to that. So I do agree with you, and I think the reason we talk a lot more about media and numbers-driven, conversations, around channels and metrics and data and stuff, is because it's safer. It's it's hard to argue with numbers. It's much harder to justify whether you know, this shot with this person smiling is better than that shot there with that person doing a different type of smile.
Yeah.
You know, I often worry that the industry is heading towards a place of mediocrity in terms of creativity. I mean, there's a lot of really good work out there now, but more so, I think, you know, things like the iPhone and the fact that, you know, taking video and photos now is completely democratized. To me, that's led to a reduction in production values and also a less appreciation for the craft of production. And I speak about this because I, you know, I really enjoy that. And this is where, you know, when I, in agency world, I was a suit, but I spend a lot of time learning the craft of production and the difference between good production values and bad production values, and those things can't be quantified. Everyone can tell you the different, tell you whether they've watched a movie that's an A grade movie or a B grade movie. People can tell you whether that looks like a B grade movie, but no one can quantify for you why it feels like a B grade movie.
Yeah, great points. And I guess how do you then articulate that importance of creative and why it should be an investment to be shaped and formed with your leadership team? How do you articulate credibly where they don't go, here's the marketing guy with his crayons about to try and colour in something?
Obviously, we want to hit objectives and make sure that we're communicating the messages that we want to communicate, right? So that's a given, right? You want to tick those boxes and ensure that the work that you're doing is communicating what you want to communicate. But ultimately, it should entertain. That's the simplest test, I think. If you show something to someone and they, you know, they kind of give you a neutral reaction, then that's not really what you want to hear, I don't think.
It's not the benchmark, is it? Yeah.
Yeah, it's not. And you don't want a neutral reaction.
Marginal uplift would be nice.
Yeah, these days that seems to be, everyone seems to be happy with that.
Hey, I've taken lots of your time. I've got a couple more questions and we'll leave you alone to run the empire, Simon. But in terms of, there's three things I want to ask you. Firstly, just consumer research and the perceptions between Menulog versus Deliveroo versus Uber Eats. Is there anything showing up that these brands are different and have a different sense and a perception in the market from a consumer perspective? Have you got any research showing anything that's different? How are you differentiated from the others?
I think more and more, like I said before, the market's becoming a bit more commoditized in terms of the offering. We don't normally speak about the competitors publicly.
Right.
So I can't really comment on how they position themselves or anything like that. But what we know is that we're finding that there is definitely a lot more commoditization now. There is a lot more misattribution out there now because there are more players.
Ah, right.
And so because of that, you know, again, creative, your distinctiveness and how you differentiate is a lot more important than ever.
Great. So final question for you. You talked about investing in, you know, the investment between brand and performance last year. What does this year look like for you, the plans for this year? Are there major shifts underway for 2020 from 2020 and what you're going to do this year, or is it a continuation? What will we like to see from Menulog this? What are we likely to see from Menulog this year? The entire strategic plan, please, Simon. We'd like you to reveal that.
I will outline that for you right now. So you can definitely expect to see a lot more continuation of our brand activity and more consistent and regular presence out there. Obviously, continue investing in our performance activity and making sure we're capturing all that great demand out there. So a lot more of the same, really consolidating all the great work that has been done in 2020. 2020 was a year that, you know, we're not going to have one like that possibly ever, particularly in our industry. We're going to be focusing a lot more on growing in particular geographies this year. So a lot more into regional areas. We're quite strong in regional areas of Australia at the moment. We have a really big focus on the inner city areas. You know, we'd like to really grow our business in New Zealand. The last thing, if I can just mention, continued focus on what we call driving more occasions. So that's really been a really big driver of our growth last year. And that's really about growing, like I said, growing in those occasions outside of dinner. So growing breakfast and late night. Our breakfast business has grown 30%. You know, at the back end of last year, and our late night has grown about 60%, and so a lot of this has come off the back of our investment and our delivery fees and being priced competitively in those periods that we call non-dinner periods. So we are the only aggregator out there that offers a $1.99 delivery fee outside of dinner. So that's, you know, that's on average half what the competitors would have, right? Other occasions that we're targeting are occasions associated with sport. We're obviously in bed with the NRL, did a major activation with the State of Origin last year. We have a major partnership with the South Sydney Rabbitohs, and all of that is about building upon the takeaway occasion that is associated with sport.
Well, it's a great point on occasions, because I don't even think, to be honest, about even, you know, a delivery for breakfast. Never until you've just said it then, it hasn't even been on my radar, and I go, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about that. There's some low-hanging fruit there just in terms of awareness. Someone like me going, oh, I should be able to do, I can do breakfast. I never thought that.
Yeah, that's right. And a lot of people are in that same boat, right? So for us, it's really about building a stronger awareness that our offering is, you know, will eventually become 24-hour. You know, the industry talks about how this, how there are traditionally 21 meal occasions in a day, right? Breakfast, lunch, no, sorry, in a week, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right? But we are now thinking beyond that and positioning the brand as an on-demand brand, as opposed to just targeting three meal occasions a day. It's about being able to have a more vast array of options at any time of day. So if you feel like something at 2 a.m. or 3 a.m., 4 a.m., you know, there is an option there for you.
And the final one, Simon, is it's probably the one that we talked about earlier. There's a little bit of heat around the sector, the debate that's going on publicly about the future sustainability of restaurants with the commission or the take that the aggregators will do for taking the order, and the gig economy. How do you see that playing out this year? Will that settle, do you think?
Oh, look, what's interesting about this is, so firstly, I should say that Menulog has the lowest average commission of any player out there. So we charge less to restaurants to provide the service that that we all, you know, provide to them. The other interesting thing is that we have actually been doing this for far longer than a lot of our other competitors. And so up until the point that our competitors came to this market 5 or 6 years ago, the industry, the restaurant industry, and Menulog have been operating harmoniously and very, you know, operating very effectively in driving incremental growth and helping the restaurant industry grow. All right, it's not until the other players join the market that a lot of these issues have actually come up. You know, we're still relatively new to the delivery game. Like I said, up until this point, we were helping restaurants that did their own delivery grow their business, and now we are providing logistics services, just like the competitors do, to restaurants that don't currently offer that to help them grow their business as well. And we're still new to the game.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Your legacy is probably more aligned to a model for the restaurant, a sustainable restaurant model, as I guess, or food model. That's kind of what you're saying, because you've been around that long.
Yeah, and so because of that, the issues that have come up, sometimes I feel like they're a little bit overinflated. Like I said, with the industry and Menulog have operated, you know, very well up until this point.
I do want to get to disruption and what the future food industry looks like in 5 years' time and so forth. Is there big disruption coming to the industry in 5 years' time? Will we see something, a very different food restaurant sector in 5 years or 6 years' time, do you think, Simon?
I think we're going to see lots of disruption in every category within the next 5 years, judging from the year we've had and even just the last 3 years that the whole industry has experienced, not just our industry, but many industries. I think, you know, I think there's a lot of things that are yet to happen that none of us could will be able to foresee.
Well, let me give you one example. So I'm aware of, and I can't remember who had the conversation, but there is someone telling me about how some restaurants or some food entrepreneurs are now sitting and going, they're setting up industrial kitchens in an industrial area to service the food aggregation delivery service and not even having a shop front for walk past or walk-in traffic. Are they Are they little blips and innovations on the side of the sector, or do you think that will become a bit more into the centre and more core to how a business, a food business, will look like?
Yeah, so there is a bit of that in the industry at the moment. They call them dark kitchens. There's a couple of types of dark kitchens there. We would, we're not supportive of one model of the dark kitchen where a lot of aggregators will set up their own dark kitchen and effectively are competing against the restaurants out there. And so we don't support that model, but we are, you know, we are very supportive of the model where restaurateurs are setting up their own commercial kitchens in back streets and not on high streets. And so that's definitely something there'll be a lot more of that to come. I think you only need to look to Asia to see the developments. Well, not just Asia, but many other countries. But to see what the future could potentially look like, you know, in places like Singapore. Apartment design is now taking into account the fact that people order out a lot more. I mean, people generally eat out a lot in a lot of those countries, but that because of the likes of the growth of the delivery industry in those countries, a lot of the apartments are being developed with no kitchens.
Is that right? Literally? Really?
That's right.
Do you see that happening here?
I can't see that happening here.
So that's interesting. Well, listen, there's a really good basis for another conversation there. I think we've gone too long and you've got things to do. So Simon Cheng, great talking. Look forward to catching up in another 6 months. Stay safe and we'll talk again. And all the best for the next six to 12 months.
Great. Thank you, Paul. It's been an absolute pleasure. I had a lot of fun.
Cheers, Simon.
Thanks, mate.
MI3 Audio Edition was presented by Paul McIntyre. That's moi, in collaboration with Podcast One Australia. Producer Nick Slater, music by Matt Dwyer. For more episodes, go to podcastone.com.au or search MI3 Audio Edition on Apple Podcasts and hit the subscribe button.